You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. Fiona, what do you have for us today?
Well, we've got the latest on the ASEANA crash. We've got Japan announcing what it says are the toughest nuclear regulations in the world, and also Japan getting ready for a very important election.
Thanks very much indeed, Fiona. Also coming up,
ABC News live coverage of a crash landing at San Francisco's airport today. It involved a Boeing 777 operated by ASEANA Airlines.
As two die and dozens are injured as a Boeing 777 crash lands at San Francisco, we'll get the latest and assess the broader implications for the aviation industry and brand career.
We'll also be checking in with our correspondent in Milan. We'll leaf through the Turkish front pages as well. And
we'll be behind the scenes of a new exhibition that asks how London's club culture in the 1980s influenced the city's catwalk culture today.
People made their outfits in the day to wear out that evening, and there were no restraints on what they did.
All that plus we'll play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The South Korean airline ASEANA says the pilot of the Boeing 777, which crashed at San Francisco Airport on Saturday, was still in training for the aircraft when he attempted to land it under supervision. Lee Kang-kook, the second most junior pilot of four on board the aircraft, had 43 hours' experience flying the long-range jet. It was his first attempt to land a 777 at San Francisco, although he had flown there 29 times previously on different types of aircraft. Two people died and over 180 more were injured in the crash. Deborah Hersman, chairperson of the National Transportation Safety Board, says the crew tried to abort the landing less than 2 seconds before coming down. And she also said the plane was flying far slower than the normal approach speed.
There was a call out for a go around from one of the crew at 1.5 seconds prior to impact. And the call out is communication between the crew that they want to go around. That means they want to not land, but apply power and go around and try to land again. That call came 1.5 seconds before impact.
The number of people killed in Saturday's freight train disaster in Canada now stands at 5, with 40 more still missing. The train, which did not have an engineer on board, was transporting 72 tanker cars of crude from North Dakota to eastern Canada. It rolled downhill from an overnight parking spot, gathered speed and derailed on a bend in the small town of Lac-Mégantic in Quebec at 1 a.m. on Saturday. Each car was carrying 30,000 gallons of crude oil. Four caught fire and exploded, flattening dozens of buildings, including a popular bar. Prime Minister Stephen Harper has visited the scene and says it's a terrible sight.
You know, it looks like a war zone here. A large part of the downtown has been destroyed. It is really just terrible. There's been loss of life, as we all know, and there are still many, many people missing. So there are many people here who are very worried, and I just want to say, you know, what I just said a moment ago. I was in Calgary last night with 1,000 people, and we're getting all across the country. People are very concerned about what's happened here. The community here is in everybody's thoughts and prayers.
Deadlock over Egypt's interim prime minister entered a third day today after the Islamist Nour party rejected two candidates for the job, prolonging the impasse amid huge protests that turned violent and killed more than 35 people. After the army removed President Mohamed Morsi last week, the transitional administration put forward two possible liberal-minded choices for the key position of interim prime minister over the weekend. But the Nour party said no to both men. The larger Muslim Brotherhood has said it will have no part in the military-backed political process. Zimbabwe's Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai has launched his third campaign to unseat the veteran President Robert Mugabe. The presidential and parliamentary polls take place at the end of the month. Mr. Tsvangirai said reforms needed to ensure free and fair elections in Zimbabwe on July the 31st had not been introduced. And he added that he didn't believe the forthcoming election would be legitimate.
We are faced with an election without reforms and against a leopard that has remained faithful to its spots. But our faith in God and our collective desire for real transformation will make us triumph over the setbacks we have experienced.
10 people have been killed after a float plane crashed in Alaska. The aircraft burst into flames after crashing at the airport in the town of Soldotna in the Kenai Peninsula. The de Havilland DHC-3 Otter was operated by a local air taxi company. It crashed at around 11:20 local time on Sunday morning. It's still not clear whether it was leaving or landing at the time. US Secretary of State John Kerry's wife, Teresa, is in hospital in Boston being treated for an unspecified medical condition. According to a source close to the family, she was taken ill around 4 p.m. on Sunday and taken away by ambulance to the local hospital on the island of Nantucket, where the family has a holiday home. The source declined to provide further details on her health, other than to say that her trip to the hospital from the family's home was necessitated by a medical condition rather than an accident. She's since been moved to Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. We'll be hearing from Barney in about 24 minutes now with another check of the world news. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
It's time to set the day's news agenda with the three stories we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day. It is the turn of Fiona Wilson, Monocle's bureau chief in Tokyo today. She joins us now on the line. Fiona, I think we're going to be exploring the San Francisco air crash in a little more depth in a few moments' time. But if you could just bring us up to date with the way that the crash is being covered where you are.
Well, you know, obviously being covered extensively as it is everywhere in the world, but there was an announcement that's gone out basically saying that the co-pilot of the flight that crashed, who was actually flying the plane, had only had 43 hours of experience of flying a 777. You know, regulators are very quick to say that's not necessarily the reason it crashed, but obviously there's a lot of focus on that.
Absolutely, Fiona. And as Emma mentioned, we'll be speaking to David Learmont, an airline safety expert at Flight Global, in just a moment, as well as our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, for his analysis. But let's move on to another story which has grabbed your eyes. Japan having the world's most stringent nuclear regulations. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, you know, whether that's true or not remains to be seen. This is what they're trumpeting today, the Nuclear Regulation Authority, which is a relatively new body that was set up last September. This all comes in the wake of the tsunami and nuclear disaster in March 2011. There are new regulations, which they are saying are the toughest in the world. Basically, Japan only has 2 reactors working at the moment, 50 are idle, and clearly the power companies would like to get them working again. There's really strong public opinion, you know, against this happening. So it's going to be quite a tough battle. And I think a lot of people are very sceptical about just how tough these regulations really are.
There was a drive a few weeks ago where they were re-engaging one of the reactors, and public authorities in Japan were saying that they were feeling as if they were being ridden roughshod over, given the more politicised drive to bring nuclear power back into Japan. Is the divide being getting ever more deeper, or is there any kind of compromise being drawn in terms of an acceptance that nuclear power will have to be part of Japan's future?
I mean, I don't think there is that acceptance. It's interesting. I mean, the governing party, the LDP, is the only party now that's opposed to getting rid of nuclear power in Japan for good. So it stands alone. It happens to be running the government at the moment, but it's interesting. It's out on a limb, and I think it's, you know, the economy is a completely separate issue and people support what's happening there. But on the nuclear issue, it's definitely on its own. And I think consistently in polls, people are saying they don't want nuclear power anymore.
And this is still, of course, happening all the while. There is continuing blackouts in parts of the country. There are power surges in different parts of the country. What kind of impact has that actually had on public opinion towards nuclear power?
Well, you know, to be honest, a lot of that talk about, you know, blackouts was put about by power companies, and, you know, really it didn't materialise, in fact. And I think that the scaremongering, once people realised actually life goes on, you know, they just didn't buy these stories from the power companies anymore. I mean, what is a reality is the increased use of fossil fuels, which is, of course, made Japan's CO2 output go up. That is a problem. And I think in the long term, people are saying, look, Japan has the technology to look at alternative sources of energy. Can we put the money there? We don't want to support TEPCO particularly, which were the operators of the plant that's caused so much trouble, Fukushima Daiichi. They're really not trusted anymore. And I think people feel that they're saying the right thing. They're doing a heavy PR campaign, but really people aren't sensing real change. And also they're aware that the situation in Fukushima has not been resolved. There's an awful lot of contaminated water sitting there. Nobody seems to know what to do with. So I think there's quite a long way to go to reassure the public on this matter.
Fiona, let's move on to the impending elections in the upper house in Japan. Yesterday, there was a debate between the party leaders, but this is very much Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's personal mission to pretty much take control of everything that he can lay his hands on.
It does seem that way. I mean, nobody would get that excited about an upper house election in the general run of things, but it's an interesting moment in Japan. The LDP, Shinzo Abe's party, is dominant clearly in the lower house, and now it's looking to take control of the upper house. Now, it's very complicated, the mathematics of the seats arrangement in this upper house, but basically it wants to make a couple of key changes, key amendments to the constitution, which was written after the war by the Americans. Now, the LDP, Shinzo Abe's party, it's a right-wing party, it's a nationalist party, it feels that the constitution doesn't fit modern Japan, and it wants to make a couple of changes. These are not small changes. One of them would be renouncing Article 9, which is famously the article that renounces war as a means of settling disputes. And the other one is a slightly more technical one about allowing it. The government would need 2/3 majority to make any amendments to the constitution. They want to change that article. So, you know, whether this will actually happen isn't clear. But what is clear is that they are going to win with their coalition partners. They're going to win control of the upper house. And it's starting Japan sort of down a path of change.
And of course, much of this rests with the economy. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been relatively, you know, applauded for his so-called Abenomics, his three arrows. He needs to win this really to pass those reforms, the monetary reforms that he wants to get done.
I mean, that's interesting. You've hit the nail on the head there. That's exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about the economy. He's being actually pretty quiet on constitutional changes. I think he's realised that the public in general are not dying to see changes to the constitution. This is just not a priority. The priority is getting the economy back on track, seeing Japan moving in the right direction economically. Going on about Article 9 is actually not where most people are, you know, that's not what most people are concerned about. They want to know about their salaries, house prices. That's the real issue. And I noticed that yesterday in the debate, he was really focusing on the economy. Of course, the constitutional issues came up. But I think for him, he knows that his winning ticket is talking about the changes to the economy, kickstarting the economy with the stimulus and seeing Japan moving in that direction.
It is one of those things that it always does boil down to, it's the economy, stupid. When it comes to Shinzo Abe, though, he's had to pretty much embrace the term Abenomics, hasn't he? Because that's always one of those kisses of death when someone gives you a little moniker. You stand or fall by it. Has he managed to embrace it?
I think he's rather reveling in it, actually, because while it's going well, you know, who wouldn't want the moniker? It's quite nice. I mean, I totally agree with you. You know, when it's going wrong, maybe he won't be so delighted. He'll wish it was somebody else's nomics. But at the moment, it suits him very well. And I think it's really helping him with this coming election. And it's, you know, it's what people are really talking about. It's what preoccupies the newspapers. And constitutional changes are a sort of technical side.
And Fiona, finally, we've been basking over here in London with some scorching temperature. I think it hit something like 31 degrees here yesterday. But Japan also experiencing a heat wave.
Oh, I mean, just phenomenal temperatures here. It was just unbelievable in Tokyo yesterday. It felt like your skin was going to burn just going outside. There's a Pacific system that's causing incredibly hot weather. And even in places like Hokkaido, which should be in the, you know, nice cool mid-20s, they were hitting temperatures like 33 yesterday. Apparently it was 38 degrees in Yamanashi today. So it's really, really hot. But the day did end yesterday with a spectacular rainstorm. I just haven't seen anything like it in Tokyo. It was properly tropical rain bouncing off the ground.
Well, Fiona, try to stay cool and dry over there in Tokyo. Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, thanks very much for setting the day's agenda here on Midori House.
Coming up, we assess the impact of the crash landing of a Boeing 777 at San Francisco on Saturday.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
This is ABC News live coverage of a crash landing at San Francisco's airport today. It involved a Boeing 777 operated by Asiana Airlines. We do know that
breaking coverage there in the United States from ABC of the Boeing 777 that crash landed at San Francisco's International Airport on Saturday. Eyewitnesses reported something not quite right with Asiana Airlines Flight 214 as it approached the runway.
Two died, hundreds were injured, and within moments, every television news outlet sat for hours on the pictures of a burnt-out fuselage covered in fire retardant. Well, in a moment, we'll be speaking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, for his analysis. But before we do, we're joined now by David Learmont, an airline safety expert at Flight Global. David, thanks very much for joining us on the program. The latest news coming out overnight saying this pilot had only 43 hours of flying experience on the Boeing 777. That's quite an astoundingly low figure.
Yes, but there wasn't one pilot on the flight deck. There was another pilot who had lots and lots of experience on the type. And of course, if pilots don't start somewhere with flying a new type of airplane, then they'll run out of pilots. So there's always going to be a day when an inexperienced pilot is on board. Now, okay, this is an interesting little fact, but I doubt if it will have anything to do with the reason why this accident happened.
David, looking at the facts that are emerging, the plane approached too low. It landed too soon. One of the crew made a request to go around and make a second approach. And the speed when it hit the ground was much, much lower than is normally expected for a landing. What does that say to you about what happened?
Well, yes, the sources, the source of the information that the speed was far too low has come from the top of the National Transportation Safety Board, the chairman of it, Deborah Herzman. So that's a totally credible piece of information that we've got there. What we've got to find out now is why on earth the aircraft was going too slowly. It was a beautiful day. The pilots were flying the airplane by looking out the front window, which is what they should be doing. It was not engaged with an instrument landing system, i.e. it was not flying down a beam to land. The pilots were flying it themselves. They don't usually do that. One of the problems with modern airplanes is they're amazing pieces of engineering. They're terribly safe compared with history. But they're terribly highly automated. And I'm thinking already, was this a situation that the pilots have become so used to the automation doing things so well without them that they weren't monitoring their airspeed as they should have been? There have been two incidents like this in the last 5 years or so.
Talk to me a bit about the cockpit culture. Some people criticizing not only Asiana Airlines, but other airlines across Asia for having this so-called authoritarian culture, not being able to critique or criticize or oppose perhaps the more senior figure there on the flight deck. Do you think there's any truth behind that and what kind of influence that has had in this crash?
Well, yes. I mean, okay, this is a totally valid point. But that authoritarian gradient, you've got a captain and you've got a co-pilot. Now, there's no point in having a co-pilot if the co-pilot, when he or she thinks the captain is doing the wrong thing, unless the co-pilot is able to challenge the captain and the captain takes notice of what's being told to him. You know, unless this takes place, there's no point in having a co-pilot at all. You might as well chuck him out the window. So, yes, that problem exists. There is a problem, and I'm not talking about in Asian aviation. If you think about the politeness, the greetings, the method of greetings that you see in Japan, in Asia Pacific, there is a greater respect for authority, a greater respect for age. You know, these things come into the cockpit. But this is a very, very well-known problem. And Asian airlines and Asian aviation authorities have been working to make the airlines aware of it and to get over it. But accidents in which a failure by a co-pilot to challenge what the captain is doing, they happen in Western airlines too. Now, this may still be a factor. It may be. But I'm saying this is not unique to Korea or to Asia.
David Learmonth, thank you very much indeed. We're joined now by our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who is listening to that. Tyler, this is the first fatal crash involving an airline from Korea since 1997. But it just takes one incident like Saturday's, where the whole of the world sees nothing but images of burnt-out fuselages, to really undermine a very strong reputation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, as David was saying a little bit earlier as well, this is a well-known fact. Korea has been in the spotlight, and we have to look back, not for Asiana, but really even in the run-up to that, where Korean Air had a very, very bad reputation. And, of course, that's still the biggest carrier out of the country. And they went through, you know, a massive cultural restructure. They brought in consultants from all over the world. There were people who were seconded from U.S. airlines to really look at this cockpit culture. So, of course, it was addressed, but you're talking about cultural issues as well, which, you know, can't just be eradicated by consultants. We should also just point out very quickly, I think one thing we've seen in the press, there's been a discussion, of course, about, and your dates are right in terms of passenger aircraft fatalities, but Asiana did have a very significant crash with a 747 2 years ago, which crashed just south of Korea as well. So they've had two major hull losses, and still not a lot of clarity as to what brought that 747 down. That was a cargo aircraft, though.
So, Tyler, let's move this story forward. What happens now to Asiana Airlines? Do they need that overhaul that Korean Airlines had back in 1997, looking at their training programs?
I'm sure that they have an excellent training program already, but one has to wonder, was that something that was implemented 7 or 8 years ago? Was it time for a refresh? So I'm sure that's going to come under the spotlight. I think we saw a lot of discussion over the weekend, certainly a lot of people, ex-NTSB, people in various, positions with the U.S. Department of Transport, talking about cultural issues. So that's going to be one component. I think the bigger issue, though, is, of course, you just have the Korean boom, and it's something we talk about all the time. So there's going to be a lot of work that has to be done, I think, on a federal level within Korea, also the airline as well, to restore passenger confidence because, you know, memories are long. They're also rather short as well. And Emma, as you were saying, you see these extraordinary images. One thing often that happens is airlines are very quick, PR teams are very quick to put some type of shroud over the aircraft's fuselage, the tail might have disappeared. You had Asiana actually sort of printed below the window line. So, you know, airlines often they don't want to see this image of their logo flashed up on screens around the world because, you know, this you know, quite literally remains branded in people's minds. So there's going to be much work done there. When you go onto Asiana's website, it is quite curious to go there at the moment, and you have the pop star Psy in this sort of, very sort of happy, clappy, come and fly our airline. And that probably needs to be addressed also from a PR point of view at the moment.
Which is the market that you think will need the most addressing in terms of restoring the PR reputation? The two people who died in the crash were Chinese teenagers. But where do you think the problem will lie the most?
I think definitely Asia. You're talking about numbers, in and around sort of 50% of the traffic going through Incheon. Of course, South Korea's major hub. 50% of that traffic, is connecting somewhere else, and that's going eastbound and westbound. With an emerging economy, or even an established economy now like China, There's definitely a vanity play. There's also a shopping play as well. So if you're in Shanghai or if you're in Guangzhou, a lot of people want to connect through Incheon and shop there. I mean, this is, you know, one of the big selling points is it has one of the world's, you know, most admired duty-free programs. So I think they're going to have to work on certainly on China, because it's not just a question that Chinese passengers, you know, want to buy the cheapest tickets. You know, part of the attraction is also just flying through a very good airport. But if there's a safety question mark, there's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done there. Also, I think that, you know, in North America, this is going to be under the spotlight. The NTSB, of course, are leading this investigation. So it's going to be, you know, very transparent. You know, no amount of spin is going to be able to paint a different type of picture. So I think they'll also have to work on North American passengers as well.
Tyler, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The 1980s in London, like many cities around the world, were heady times indeed. Of course, Phil and I have no recollection of the era Babes in Arms we were. Now, thank goodness for a new exhibition, therefore, which opens here in London later this week. It explores how the club scene in the British capital set the bar for the city's fashion.
The effects, the exhibits, curators say, are still visible on London's catwalks today. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco was given a look at the exhibition by curator Kate Bethune and video artist Jeffrey Hinton, who produced the exhibition From the Club to the Catwalk at London's Victoria and Albert Museum.
My name's Kate Bethune. I'm the assistant curator working on the Club to Catwalk exhibition. And the exhibition looks at the creative explosion of London fashion across the decade, and it looks at the emerging theatricality in fashion, and particularly how this was reflected in style magazines and in the club scene, that was so much of a part of the creative impetus behind all the young designers working at the time.
How influential was the London fashion club scene in the 80s? Can you feel the influence even nowadays?
It was hugely influential. I mean, I think London is a very special place. It's always been seen as a very creative hub. And I think part of that is because of its street culture, and part of that is because of the club scene. And in the 80s, you see so many different clubs opening up and so many different club nights. People really didn't have an awful lot of money. Fashion wasn't backed in the same way that it was today. And this enabled young designers to take risks with their designs. It didn't matter if they didn't make it. No one knew who was going to make it.
Shall we go through some of the outfits here? And you mentioned that the theatricality of the fashion in the 80s in London, and you can see in the costumes here. So is London always the experimental capital in terms of fashion, do you think? Because even nowadays, it's still considered where things start.
I think there is definitely a sense that London's been very bold and daring and creative from the outset. So we have cases that really combine both elements. We have a case called Tradition and Subversion. Tailoring is always seen to be a great strength of British designers. So we have a classic Paul Smith suit, but then this is paired alongside an ensemble by a designer called Joe Casely Hayford. And it was from his Brick Lane collection. And it's a transitional piece with the shirt that can be worn and styled if it was to be worn for day or night. So there are little subversive elements and subversive twists.
I'm curious about the first one, as you can see in the exhibition, this orange jacket.
Yeah, so I think fun and playfulness are other key themes that really come through in the 80s design culture. And Michiko Kishino is a Japanese-born designer, and she's great. It's a real transitional piece because it really shows the crossovers between club and catwalk. People likened her store to more of a club than a traditional clothing store because she played loud music and club music. And this piece is an orange PVC inflatable jacket, and it's got cat's ears and tails, so it's really fun and quirky.
Yeah, what about Blitz Denning?
I would say Blitz was a really important style magazine in the 1980s. Prior to the 80s, we didn't really have very many colourful magazines that looked at fashion and urban culture and music culture. And in 1986, Ian R. Webb, who was the fashion editor of Blitz magazine, approached a group of 22 designers and asked them to customise the classic Levi's denim jacket. And customization was such a key tenet of 80s style. And here you can again really see the unbridled creativity with the designers as they customized the jackets. We have one by Lee Bowery. He chose to cover his in hundreds of golden hair grips, and it weighs nearly 9 kilograms. And then next to that, we have one by Stephen Linnard, which is festooned with cutlery. It's known as a camping jacket. So it's quite an interesting take on a Levi's jacket. And then we have a lovely distressed bleached one by Vivian Westwood as well.
At the 80s, there was a very strong correlation between fashion and music. I mean, there's still nowadays, but can you tell us a bit how fashion influenced music as well? There was the new romantics as well.
I think there was a real intersection in the 80s between music, fashion and performance. And this is what you really see in these new style magazines, especially the Face magazine, which looked more at music culture and urban culture. And again, in the clubs, with the clubs acting as a catwalk for people to try out their designs. It was also a real DIY spirit to dressing up at the time. People made their outfits in the day to wear out that evening, and there were no restraints on what they did. So New Romantics started when the theatrical costumier Charles Fox closed down in Covent Garden, and all the clubbers of the day went and bought up the stock and then wore them out to the Blitz Club in the evening. So you would have people dressed in Robin Hood next to people in Regency military style wear, next to preachers, you know, absolutely anything went.
My name's Jeffrey Hinton. I'm connected with this exhibition because during this period of time I was living in a squat called Warren Street, and a lot of the designers that you see in this exhibition are people that also lived in that creative little bubble that was going on. And I was asked to formulate a mix of music to go along with the kind of club referencing from that time, because I also, you know, DJed a lot around that time. And yeah, and I did a lot of visual work, and they asked me to do the kind of visual photographic film archive that I have, and also place it in this do a special thing for this exhibition.
And it's nice to see some images, because I mean, you can see the mannequins, but you can't really see their hair and makeup. So right. you do need to see sometimes on your little video installation.
I'm glad you see that, because obviously clothes and looks come to life from the people that are wearing them. And really during this time, people were wearing and having a great amount of joy making and creating stuff for themselves and their friends. And a lot of the time, you know, all this stuff was done for each other's pleasure, not really the idea of selling it or being a successful designer, you know. Like, it wasn't such commercially minded times. We were like basically having our own little party.
What about the brilliant soundtrack? I was just listening to Fun Fun.
You were Fun Fun. That was, I think that was Colour My Love was playing at that one, which is, and Taboo, which is quite a famous club I did work at during this time, Lee Bowery's club. We were all very close, and Taboo, I liked the Italo disco sound from that period of time. And it seemed to fit that kind of naive, little joyful way of singing, very summery. And Taboo was a very small club, but I mixed it all up with visual stuff and different sorts of music. But the Italo disco sound of that time suited the mood of that place very well, very playful. Fun Fun, obviously being a typical band from that time that were like amazing, amazing little stuff.
One of the highlights. Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Fernando.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco in his element there at the V&A Museum. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And in our 1980s garb, we now hand to Barney Burnham, who brings us the latest news.
Thanks, Emma. The South Korean airline Asiana says the pilot of the Boeing 777, which crashed at San Francisco Airport on Saturday, was still in training for the aircraft when he tried to land it under supervision. Two people died and over 180 more were injured in the crash. The number of people killed in Saturday's freight train disaster in Canada now stands at 5, with 40 more still missing. Prime Minister Stephen Harper says the scene resembles a war zone. Deadlock over Egypt's interim prime minister has entered a third day after the Islamist Nur party rejected two candidates for the job, prolonging the impasse amid huge protests that turned violent and killed more than 35 people. Zimbabwe's Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai has launched his third campaign to unseat the veteran President Robert Mugabe. Mrs. Tsvangirai says reforms needed to ensure free and fair elections on July the 31st have not been introduced, and he doesn't expect the vote to be legitimate. 10 people have been killed after a float plane crashed in Alaska. The de Havilland DH3 Otter burst into flames after crashing at the airport in the town of Soldotna in the Kenai Peninsula on Sunday morning. Secretary of State John Kerry's wife, Teresa, is in hospital being treated for an unspecified medical condition. She was taken ill on Sunday afternoon and taken to the local hospital on the island of Nantucket, where the family has a holiday home. She's since been transferred to Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. The time here in London is 8:35. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson.
The singer Amy Winehouse was enigmatic, immensely talented. She was also full of demons. In tonight's edition of Culture with Robert Bound, our producer Katie Bilboa visited a new exhibition at the London Jewish Museum that examines the family life of the star instead of the drug and alcohol-laden headlines.
The abundance of international press crammed into this small room on the top floor of London's Jewish Museum says so much about Amy Winehouse, a character who lived her life in the spotlight and who, even in death, continues to fascinate. It's a tiny but brightly lit space, no bigger than a small gig venue, filled with short-skirted outfits from various performances and events, posters and photos, her eclectic record and CD collections, and an assortment of brightly coloured lanyards and tickets hoarded from festivals and gigs. But there's also a Jewish cookbook, Family Trees, an old school jumper. Curator Liz Selby shows me the battered suitcase which sits in front of you when you enter the exhibition. It's crammed full of old photographs of Amy and her family.
I think there's a real poignancy to the object because Amy was looking through the photographs just before she died, and she actually called her dad to come and look through them with her, and that was the last time her dad actually saw her. It's full of photographs that Amy held on to, even though some of them aren't particularly well taken, some of them are incredibly blurry, but it doesn't look like she ever threw anything out, so I think they were obviously very important to her.
And it strikes me a bit that this suitcase is a microcosm of the exhibition itself, trying to distill a life into a small space.
Yeah.
How did you curate this?
Well, Amy's brother and sister-in-law, Reva, came to us originally because they felt that they wanted to offer us something to put on display, and originally it was a dress. We talked to them and we got to know a bit more about Amy and about the objects they had. We realised that the exhibition was much more about her family life and about her roots and what she was like as a person. You're so far away.
Doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? There's no mention in this exhibition of the drink and drugs that Amy Winehouse became infamous for. Nor do you hear her music. The soundtrack is about her world, taken from a playlist she made when she was about 14, titled Songs on My Chill Out Tape. We learn about Amy's grandmother, Cynthia, a strong and colourful character who Amy looked up to. Cynthia once dated jazz musician Ronnie Scott. Adorning the walls are quotes from Amy's successful application for a much-coveted scholarship at the Sylvia Young Theatre School in London. One of them reads, "All my life I have been loud, to the point of being told to shut up. The only reason I've had to be this loud is because you have to scream to be heard in my family." John Azlewood is a music critic for the London Evening Standard. He interviewed Amy at several points during her career.
There's a sort of posthumous notion that she was this tragic figure who couldn't string a sentence together, who was tottering around on these high heels. And when you spoke to her, particularly in the early days, particularly when it was just starting to happen for her, she wasn't like that at all. She was, as this exhibition suggests, a kind of nice Jewish girl who talked and talked and talked and talked. And it brings that aspect of her out.
Amy's brother Alex helped Liz curate the exhibition. His written thoughts act as signposts as you walk round.
I think he was very keen to show Amy as a person, but a person within a family. And he says in the introduction to the exhibition that Amy was the most famous person in the family, but she wasn't the centre of it. And that's very true. We get to see Amy as a well-rounded person who is very aware of her heritage and her roots. And I think that's something that people will be kind of quite surprised by.
Though Amy Winehouse's Jewish heritage may not have informed her music, it was certainly a huge part of her identity. It's a theme that the exhibition is keen to explore, as Abigail Morris, CEO of the Jewish Museum, explains.
I think it's very important because I think it's part of the private Amy that people didn't know about, and I think that's very much what this family is. It's an intimate and private thing. But I also think it's really interesting because I think she exemplifies so many traits that are common to so many Jews in this country, coming over at the end of the 19th century, that mass migration, going to the East End, then moving out to the suburbs. But also that thing of feeling very strongly Jewish, identifying very strongly, having traditional Friday nights, brother bar mitzvah, going to Jewish school, but it not being the most dominant thing about you.
For John Azerwood, exploring this other side of Amy's life is key to the exhibition's success.
As with all dead pop stars, she's preserved in this kind of aspect of a 28-year-old woman. Amy Winehouse will never get old, and the fascination with her will never die. It's not so much about keeping the myth alive. The music will do that for her. But it is important that although drugs and drink were a huge part of her life, that she's not just remembered as someone who fell by the wayside because of her personal demons.
This isn't the kind of show that strikes you with the monolithic power of David Bowie at the V&A. It's just a small thing, slightly sugar-coated, but deeply personal too. And it helps to deal with the illusion so often conjured by celebrity culture, that we actually know something about the person we idolise, when in fact we only see what's projected into the public gaze. For Monocle in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
And you can hear Katie's report and much more on the latest edition of Culture that airs at 1900 hours here on Monocle 24 today.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with the latest from our man in Milan.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, where the time here in London is just turned 8:43. Time now for our daily check-in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today, we're heading to Milan. And our correspondent there, Ivan Carvalho, joins us on the line. Ivan, sorry about that. Let's begin, though, with Pope Francis, his first trip outside of Rome.
Yeah, good morning, Phil. Yes, Pope Francis is traveling outside Rome. And interesting his choice. He's going to Lampedusa, which is an Italian island in the Mediterranean. It's very close to Tunisia and Libya, and it's a destination point of a lot of refugees. And it's quite symbolic, really, because Pope Francis is always looking to help the poor, those disenfranchised, and he wants to draw attention to this place because lots of migrants risk their lives every year coming by boat to seek asylum in the EU. And so it's going to be a very interesting trip today.
This strikes me as a very politicised move, because one would imagine that he would perhaps concentrate on the more immediate issues of Italian poverty.
Yeah, I mean, Pope Francis is looking to really draw attention to the plight of people maybe who are not get as much attention as perhaps other groups. And you know, this visit is again, he's been one that's trying to bring the church close to the people, close to the poor. And on this trip, his entourage is again very humble. They're an islander is lending a jeep so he can travel around. The altar is going to be built out of these old fishing boats. I've actually visited Lampedusa in the past, and you see lots of the boats that the migrants used to travel across the straits to risk their lives to get to the island, to ask for asylum. They're then left in this sort of pile in the middle of the island, and so an artisan was asked to craft an altar out of these fishing boats. So again, he's sending this message of, you know, I'm close to those who don't have a voice.
And Ivan, let's also talk about some news. Pope Francis announcing the approval of sainthood for the late Pope John Paul II.
Yes, this is a fast track, as you might say, to sainthood. It's just been, you know, 8 years since the passing of the Polish Pontiff John Paul II, and you know, a very popular pontiff, as everybody knows. Perhaps Pope Benedict XVI wasn't seen as somebody who had the charisma, who could rally around the faithful, as John Paul II had done, and as we see from Pope Francis in his short time so far as pontiff. Very popular move. We expect probably large crowds for the ceremony in Rome, which should be within the year. There's also it'll be a dual sainthood because of also the other pontiff from the 20th century, John Paul the 23rd, another very populist pope, will also be celebrated his canonization as well. So something that Pope Francis is moving forward, trying to push that to sort of bring people again, maybe sort of a popular decision, really, to have some attention brought onto the church after these recent scandals. You might recall the Vatican Bank scandal we talked about recently. There were some resignations there. This is all part of seen as perhaps Pope Francis' move to clean up things in the Vatican.
Oh, indeed, Pope John the 23rd, who you refer to, is actually being given the sainthood after only one miracle, as opposed to two, which apparently is the standard entry level for sainthood. So one must only wonder what kind of miracle that must have been. Ivan, let's turn to more earthly issues. To Kova, a very beautiful 200-year-old cafe has been snapped up by LVMH.
Yes, Kova, very elegant, as you mentioned, pastry shop, cafe in Milan. The waiters wear these white dinner jackets with black bow ties, and it's in the heart of the shopping district on Via Monte Napoleone. So it's a prize acquisition. They have franchises in Asia, in Hong Kong, in Japan, and LVMH wanted to pry this away from, actually Prada was actually bidding for this, and now there's a bit controversy because Prada is saying they're going to go to court and try to block this acquisition, and Prada has even gone so far as the Louis Vuitton Cup, which is going on in San Francisco now, this yacht regatta. Prada pulled out of the boat race, so they're quite upset about this cafe being pinched from under their noses, because as everyone knows, Prada is founded in Milan, and to have this another Italian luxury label or prize, prestigious brand being taken away by the French is unnerving. I mean, as we know, Bulgari, the jeweler brand, was bought by LVMH, and you've seen lots of acquisitions by foreign companies, groups. For example, the yacht maker Ferretti Group in Italy, a very large group that holds also the Riva brand amongst its collection, was bought by the Chinese. So the Italians are losing these prized bits in the crown jewel to foreigners.
And finally, Ivan, what can you tell us about the summer sales season? Shopping season kicks off there in Milan. Is it good news for retailers?
Yeah, well, let's say that there's not as long lines as we've seen in the past, and I think a lot of retailers are hoping for the foreigners, the tourists to come in, whether it's the Russians from Asia, Chinese, or from the Gulf states to fill in the gap, since purchasing power and the pocketbooks of many Italians isn't as let's say, abundant as it used to be.
Monocle's man there in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, many thanks for joining us on the program.
It's nearly 10:49 a.m. in Istanbul, 8:49 a.m. here in London. Before we head to Turkey for today's newspaper review, it's time for a song. This is Murat Del Kilic with Yudum Yudum.
Acılar bile hep sende son bulurken ikim.
That's everyone's favourite song, isn't there? Isn't
Absolutely.
It, Emma? You're a fan of Murada Kilic?
Oh, give me more.
Someone who is, I think, a big fan is Alex de Kramer. She's here with the Turkish Front Pages. Alex, are you a fan of Murat?
Of course. Yeah? He's from my hometown.
That's not what you said last time.
I think it grew on me. You know, the more I listen to it, the more I like it.
That's an incredibly steely grin that you're forcing in the studio today. You have brought in a roundup of the Turkish newspapers. Mm-hmm. What's the top story?
So, Gezi Park opens today to the public. It was supposed to open yesterday. So, that's Radikal's headline. And they have a picture of yesterday's protest. People called it Gazadan because Ramadan officially starts today after sunset. So, people yesterday in Gezi Park were just celebrating the first annual gas holiday because they've been gassed so much. So, they thought it would be fun to do
that's
protests
quite a
like
stoic
that.
Spirit that they've adopted.
Let's get gassed again.
Yeah. I've never actually heard of a nation actually embracing being fired upon with tear gas. It's astonishing, though, that Gezi Park is reopening and has been a real challenge to Erdogan's authoritarianism, hasn't it?
It has indeed. They actually wanted to open it yesterday, but because of this first annual gas protests, they were unable to. And it's actually shows that the because of what has happened in Egypt, obviously, that the Gezi Park demonstrations have been not front page as they were. But it's important to know that they're still happening. I think an interesting thing that's happening as well around, other than the protests, are assemblies, like in ancient Greece times. Apparently 50 parks in Istanbul have them, and it has spread around the country. They're called forums, where people, there's a stage and people go and just discuss political situations, and they have kind of hand gestures to agree, disagree, or tell the speaker to wrap up, which I feel it's another level of democracy that's happening. And you're giving the floor to anyone to speak and just having these like little city councils.
And taking some inspiration as well from the Occupy movements around the world.
Exactly. I think that's what inspired them.
May I ask, when the protests occurred in the last few weeks, mm-hmm. And the television stations just completely ignored it, although you know it went black, We've often spoken here on Monocle 24 about the Turkish media's inability to report freely. There is that widespread figure
still
that,
going on,
that
yeah.
there are more Turkish journalists in prison than there are in China. When you're looking at the papers to do the paper review, are you having to cut through swathes of redacted stuff, or is there a sort of a sense that there is free expression?
It depends on the newspaper. I have also Cumhuriyet, which is the only out of the three that I have. So I have Hürriyet, Milliyet, and Cumhuriyet in front of me. Out of the three, Cumhuriyet is the only one that has the first gas. Let's say protests as
on their front page,
and the picture of that, and others don't even mention it. And I kind of get my headlines and then get deeper into the story from let's say columnists and people. What I hear from people and what they've posted, because it's still of course there's some columnists that are really bold and talking about subjects, but it's not coming across from the first pages of the newspapers.
Alex, let's move over to the Hürriyet newspaper, which I think you've got a copy there as well. A new metro line has just been opened over the weekend.
Yes, so they officially opened the connecting metro line between bus terminal in Esenler and the Olympic Village, Olympiadköy. And Erdogan read it. It was a big opening. Mayor Kadir Topbaş had test-driven the line in 2011, but it just got completed, although it was supposed to be completed in 2011. So, and he gave a big speech about condemning, other than separate to mentioning how amazing it is. It's basically, this is like a prep for Olympics, because it's like going to take 10 minutes to get to the Olympic Village.
But they haven't won the Olympic, the right to host the Olympics. They'll find out.
It'll still take you 10 minutes to get there, whether they use it or not. We were just talking before we came on air. I dipped my toe in a swimming pool this weekend. Phil Hon swam in the Serpentine in London. Wow. And so we're just
along
waiting.
With the geese and the ducks.
We're waiting to see if anything happened, Alex. Nonetheless, there was an even more ambitious race that took place in Istanbul this weekend. Tell us about it.
So it was a 25th Bosporus race, for where from you cross from the Asian side to the European side. And there were 1,500 almost people swimming across. So it sounds really fun. Six and a half kilometer race.
Have you ever been tempted?
No. I feel like because actually in the street there's so much current. The current is really strong, and they always tell you don't swim. In this train,
and so much boat traffic. And there are so many ferries and cargo ships that are crisscrossing the Bosphorus. It's amazing to
Do
think.
Do they ask them to stop for a
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, I think so.
It like, would be only
yeah, and I think it's like from a specific place. I don't have it in front of me now, but I think it's from specific two points because it gets larger in between. So it's not like all the same the strait. It's not like all the same from the Aegean from the Asian. Coast to the European
side. When I was in Istanbul in May, there's an amazing kind of pool club, isn't there, in the middle of the Bosphorus,
so
this huge Olympic sized swimming pool just on this tiny little island there in the middle. I think I'll just stick to that.
Did you go to it?
No, it was a bit too cold.
Is it the Suada one or the Galatasaray one?
I think it was the Suada one.
The football clubs have their kind of islands that you can go and swim on. I think it might be one of those.
Well, excellent stuff. Alex de Kramer, many thanks for leading us through this morning's Turkish Front Pages.
That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer Thomas Lewis, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Toby Hammond.
Up next, after the news headlines with Barney Burnham, is this week's edition of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds on Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn,
and me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye and thank you for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.